You know him.
He's unfortunate.
He's Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix.
Podcast Go.
And this is the Crossover NBA Show.
This guy is a freaking joke.
Hey, hey, hey. He's here to break down the league.
Nah, he's inaccurate.
That's probably true.
That's fair.
But make a game of it. Just take a drink every time Mannix says,
I was dead wrong.
See? I'm solving problems. Now here's your host.
These guys are going to run me into the ground.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. It is week two of our suspended season podcast series as we try to navigate the new landscape that's been created as a result of the spread of the coronavirus. Obviously, all of us want to see sports back. All of us want to see basketball back. But let me be the umpteenth person to remind everybody listening that it is of the most importance to stay inside, social distance, do everything that you possibly can to help beat this virus and beat back this virus until the medical experts that are out there are able to come up with a vaccine or other therapies as we try to move forward in this really challenging time for the world. I want to say our thoughts and prayers are with the family of Karl Anthony Towns. Towns' mother, Jacqueline Cruz, is battling the coronavirus. If you missed it, Towns on his Instagram page had a really emotional message for people as he described what his mother is going through on a ventilator right now and, you know, fighting for her life. And it just goes to show that this virus can affect anybody at any time in any walk of life. So do what you can. Stay inside. Try to beat this thing back so we can hopefully get back to normal sooner rather than later. On this podcast this week, I'm going to talk to Wes Wilcox, the former general manager of the Atlanta Hawks. And I'm going to try to get a sense from Wes about what front offices are doing right now. What kind of planning can take place right now? I also want to talk to Wes about the pros and cons of changing the NBA schedule. Steve Koonin, the executive with the Hawks, the organization Wes used to work for, he had submitted a plan at the Sloan Athletic Conference, Analytics Conference, I should say, about how changing the schedule might be a good thing for the NBA. Well, if the NBA does come back in the summer, it could provide the league with valuable data about whether or not changing that to schedule into something that involves the summer could be good for it. Stick around for that conversation with Wes. It's really insightful. Wes is a very smart guy, and I always like to talk to him about these topics. If you like this podcast, you can always support it by heading over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to my conversation with Wes Wilcox. All right, Wes Wilcox is here, former Atlanta Hawks general manager, NBA TV analyst, and the self-styled quarantine king who is here to tell us all about the tricks of the trade to being really good at quarantine. Is that right, Wes?
Yeah. I'm not sure what it means to be good, but, you know, certainly we've been, you know, taking the precautions that all the medical professionals have advised. You run out of books and you run out of stuff to watch on TV, and now without basketball to watch, it's, you know, that's what takes up most of our times. So, you know, it's been an interesting time for sure.
Well, let me tell you this. In all the conversations I've had with people in your position and coaches and other executives, the number one thing I hear back is some variation of I've got to get out of here. I don't think NBA personnel, Wes, was built to spend this much time at home. I think their lifestyle has been such that they're away X percentage of the time, and everybody kind of gets used to it inside their household.
For sure. I mean, you know, a big part of that is just, you know, you're so used to getting on the plane and spending, you know, 12 to 14 hours in the office every day and traveling, you know, 3 or 5 days a week, whatever it is, depending upon the time of year. But it might be the significant others that want, you know, that's work in the NBA out of there, because, you know, typically we end up screwing up the routine at home. At least that was the case in our household. And, you know, when I stopped working full time, that was a big adjustment for our family, and it's still not something we're used to. And now, of course, you layer in the fact that we're all having to become teachers again. In this time, you know, we are really, you realize how fortunate with great medical professionals and great teachers, because all of us are being forced, well, most of us with school age kids are being forced to teach like fourth, fifth, sixth grade algebra and geometry, and you're like, wow, this stuff is a lot more challenging. And then you just got to provide lunch and take care of the kids. You know, thank God and thank you to all the teachers out there who just have done a tremendous job that, you know, now us as parents are having to play that role too.
I tell you what, if you ask me to teach middle school geometry, you might as well ask me to land the space shuttle. Seriously, like I could not do it.
Well, you know, they teach math differently now too. You don't get to carry the one as we all learn to do. It's all this different, you know, you got to block everything out in tens and fives and, you know, and then you send your kids back to school and they're like, well, my mom and dad said I can carry the one. And the teacher's like, no, that doesn't count. And so you as parents have to go like Google and research how to teach your kids, you know, simple addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. It is not easy in this new form.
Teaching math a different way. That's like when they changed the SAT scores and like 10 years later, I got dumber because it went up to like 2,400 or something like that. I mean, it was wild times.
That made two of us.
Yeah. Wild times. All right. So there's a few things I want to get into with you. We're about 2 weeks into the suspension season here, and there is still right now far more questions than answers. No timeline is out there for a return. And while all of the NBA is hoping to see the season salvaged, there is definitely plenty of uncertainty about whether or not it can be. So, Wes, you're a former general manager. You certainly talk to a lot of people that are still in those positions. What are your friends, your peers in the NBA front offices? I mean, how are they passing the time on a professional level?
Well, if you focus in like just three groups within kind of basketball operations, let's say coaches, you know, they're at home. I mean, they're basically locked out of their facilities. They can't engage with the team. So coaches are on, you know, maybe there's projects you can do with video, but they're largely on, you know, a break. The player personnel guys, you know, the scouts at all levels, you know, there's a lot of work the scouts can be doing with video, but many of them are, you know, quarantined or separate in, you know, in their own cities. If and even in the city, they're not going into the office. So, but there's a lot of work you can do on video and making phone calls, trying to get background information, understanding that, you know, this draft is going to be, you know, a highly unique one. You know, people don't know if there's going to be a combine. Doesn't seem like there's going to be a combine. You know, do you have draft workouts? Maybe draft workouts aren't going to take place. But there's a lot of work that can be done on the player personnel side, planning for both draft and free agency. And then the GMs. You know, the guys who are leading or the presidents who are leading these organizations, you know, this is bigger picture stuff. You know, first of all, safety, the medical care of your team and your staff and your organization. And then thinking about, you know, all the implications of, you know, you may have stuff like as simple as staff contracts that expire June 30th and you need those people to be around if a draft is or free agency is going to go beyond that. And so, you know, trying to work through a whole host of big picture planning, player care, with the unknown of what the financial impact for all this may be.
Are there, I mean, does anybody you've talked to, and I've talked to a bunch of them as well, but do they, obviously, as I said at the top, there's a lot of uncertainty, but do they have any expectations for how this is all going to play out? I mean, what the NBA is going to push for if a window is opened up and all this?
No, I don't think there's like an expectation. There clearly is a hope that there is some portion of a season to be finished, you know, be that playoffs or, you know, some portion of a regular season or something completely, you know, unique tournament style. There's definitely a belief coming from the league that would be the goal to get something done. But that's like a, it seems to be a hope. It seems to be that's the ideal scenario. While there's, you know, the understanding that becomes a reality based upon, you know, the medical professionals and, you know, whatever is safe, because that's the number one priority for everybody involved is the health of, you know, from the staff to the players to the families to fans. That's going to lead in a situation that is so unprecedented.
Yeah, and look, I've heard largely the same, and I would say that, you know, the one thing I keep hearing from different league officials is that, you know, they're not going to put an end date on this anytime soon, right? Like, they're not going to say, well, if we don't start playing games by June 15th. That's an arbitrary number. But if we don't start playing games by this, it's over. I really think, Wes, that they'll go into September if they have to. I mean, they're probably not going to say this, but to salvage this season in some way, shape, or form and get all the revenue that comes with it, and we'll get into that a little bit later on, but I think they'll push this even further than most people expect. I mean, I just think there are too many owners that want that TV revenue and are willing to do completely outside the box things to make it happen. I don't know if you get the same sense, but that's kind of where what I'm hearing mostly.
No, I'm hearing similar things, but one of the questions that's being asked is, you know, that you hear from people around the league, talking to people in the league, like does this event displace next season or not? Mm. And what kind of impact does that have down the road? But one thing we know is that we have great leadership at the league office, Commissioner Silver and his team. And we also know that the league is creative. They're open-minded. So maybe there's, you know, some version of basketball that gets done very quickly, you know, that crowns a champion in a very unique time. You know, earlier this season, of course, we talked a lot about, you know, what the potential shortened season looked like and what an in-season tournament looks like and then a play-in, you know, tournament. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here to explore some of those options. I imagine the league is going to contingency plan multiple scenarios. And one scenario will probably be if they have 90 days to get a season in. One scenario will be if they have 60 days. Another scenario, maybe with 30 days, you know, just finding a way to get basketball back if we can, if we know it's, you know, everyone involved is going to be safe, because that will be what will lead in this situation. It's not going to be money. It's not going to be revenue. It's not going to be getting the games back. It's going to be led by the medical professionals and the safety of our players, staff, families, and all those involved.
You know, it's the word safety is interesting, because I think there's another layer to that as well. I mean, as soon as it's safe for teams to return and players to practice, I would imagine that you're going to have some kind of training camp, right? I mean, when these guys come back, Wes, I don't think they'll have ever been in this bad a shape. I mean, I know they've just played 3/4 or 4/5 of a season, but they'll effectively have 2-ish months off, where for most of them, the majority of their workouts are like these same home videos like you and I are doing at a time. Right now, they're not, I mean, except for guys that have the uber wealthy that have like their own home gyms, like in their backyards, most of these guys are just kind of hanging out at home. So, I mean, what would you suggest? What would you think is reasonable in terms of getting these guys ready for the intensity of a playoff atmosphere? Because we both know, I mean, you know, unless guys are in the proper condition, that's where real injuries happen. That's where like Achilles tears and knee injuries type stuff happen that can be real dangerous for guys' careers.
So Frank Isola and I on the starting lineup at Sirius XM NBA Radio, we interviewed Jared Dudley a week ago. We asked him this question and he said, we need at least 30 days. And he raised all the points that you raised, because this is a really unique time. You know, when we have this compressed, you know, training camp to build more time into the regular season that has happened over the last couple seasons, right? We've shortened training camp. We've shortened preseason games. But, you know, all of that, even though that's kind of the official start time right around October, you know, the players have been working out all summer long, and most of them in market since Labor Day. So the beginning of September, they're around the team for all that time ramping up into this. And to your point, and to Jared Dudley's point, you know, you're going to go from basically no interaction with the team. No, a lot of players are living in apartments or condos or townhomes, especially those who are younger in the NBA. And that's going to be, you know, even if you're in great shape, that's a huge transition to get ready. And so you're going to be, you know, extra protective again, because we're going to be led by player health. And it's not just with, you know, COVID-19, but it's going to be player health as we resume to play. And so that's why you're going to need some significant period of time to recondition before you restart play, or whatever it is that, you know, the completion of this year could look like.
30 days is a lot of days, especially with so little time left on the calendar before you start bleeding into next season. I can't imagine. Look, I get where Jared's coming from, and he's 100% right for all the reasons you just said. I mean, guys are practicing at their home facilities in early September, so that's basically a month before training camp starts. But the NBA is going to probably try to push this, I would imagine. The more people I talk to, the more people I think like a week to 10 days is what they're likely to get. And then
I don't think so.
You think it's longer?
I think it has to be. And the NBA is going to be talking to the Players Association about this. They're going to be talking to the players directly about this. This is an unprecedented break away from the teams. You know, I know teams that are sending a bunch of workout equipment to their players just to be dropped off and delivered, whether they're exercise bikes or kettlebells or bands. Like, I think most teams are doing this. They're trying to get the players, you know, the opportunity to condition themselves, and they're sending plans to the players. The medical teams are checking in daily with the players. But even then, it's going to be a challenge. And I just don't think, because player health is such a priority to everyone in the NBA, I don't think that we're going to push it to recondition the players. I would just, now maybe I'll prove to be wrong. I don't know, but it just seems like that's one area where you would not compromise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they shouldn't, that's for sure, because they're, these guys could very easily get significantly injured. But I just wonder if there's some kind of compromise reached there where they shorten it up there just to get these games in. But we'll see. That's obviously a problem for down the road until they get the all clear from the medical community to go out there and to actually play. Wes, so the biggest reason the NBA is anxious to return, of course, is that there is that huge financial incentive. There have been reports that the league could lose as much as $1 billion in total revenue if the rest of the season and the playoffs can't be resumed. That is a, insult to injury, and the injury being what happened with China early in the year, which cost them reportedly hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So, I mean, let's talk about the financial impact, what's being lost. This is largely TV revenue, right? The TV revenue is king, but in-arena revenue is pretty significant as well.
Yeah, first of all, these numbers are very hard to estimate. But if we just said there's roughly 16 games per team, 16 out of 82 games is about 20% of the season. And if you just, took a 20% reduction on BRI, now this is again, high level math. This is not pulling in all the right numbers. It'd be, well over $1 billion. And then if you could maybe do a more granular approach and say, okay, there's roughly 16 games left for each team. Half of those are home games. So that's 8 games. Multiply that by the 30 teams. And then multiply that by, let's just say, an average of $2 million a gate. The gates range. Some teams is as much as $4 million, potentially. The lower end teams as much as $1 million. But all these variables are hard to estimate. But still, if we went to the more granular level, just the regular season gate, I mean, that's why you hear these numbers around $400 million or $400 to $500 million just in gate. And then we haven't even gotten to the potential playoff revenues. And then there's a bunch of smaller revenues items like concessions, parking, retail, like all that stuff adds up. And so bottom line, this is going to be a huge financial impact. That's why you hear this $1 billion number. And that will ultimately have a trickle down effect to, the NBA salary cap next season, because that's how they set the cap, is based upon the prior year's numbers.
So what, I mean, is there any way to gauge, like, assume the season's lost, completely lost, and they have to go into next year without the revenue from the rest of this year? Is there any way to gauge, like, how big an impact would that have on the cap for next season?
Yeah, so the simple, again, if we were going to go like really simple math, let's just, this is, I would say, generally accurate. It's not going to be specifically accurate, but if you had, $1 billion lost in revenue, about half that goes to the players, so $500 million. And then the simplest way to get a general sense of what kind of cap impact is you would divide that $500 million by 30 teams. And that's how you get you get a $15 million reduction to the cap based upon that math. Now, I think that's a little high. Number one, this is not the exact to the letter way it works. I'm just giving like a broad stroke understanding. It's much more nuanced and specific than I'm laying out, but this is, you know, generally how it works. But I think more important to those numbers, Chris, is the NBA and the Players Association has the ability to negotiate to establish what the cap's going to be. And, you know, this is what we did in the 2011 lockout. They just held the cap number to be the exact same what it was the year prior. And there was a bunch of other, you know, kind of reductions based upon, you know, how many games we played. That was a 66 game season. And so we just divided everything by, you know, 66, 80 seconds or multiplied everything by 66, 80 seconds to set all the numbers into the future. And if I had to bet, even though this could be a massive financial impact with a lost season, ultimately what will be done is this will be a negotiation between the Players Association and the league office. And they'll just they'll negotiate in, you know, in great faith, understanding this is an unprecedented time. And they'll, you know, set a cap that they think everybody can work, you know, work within and around.
What do you remember, Wes, about those 2011 negotiations? Because you're right, that was a 16-game loss when it came to the start of the season. They did get, you know, wind up having the playoffs, of course, and that's a huge amount of revenue for teams. But how challenging was that negotiation in setting the cap for the league?
You know, I don't remember, Chris, exactly, but I do know the tone between Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts. You know, there was a spirit of trying to get something done, and they ultimately did get something done, you know, that was good for everybody. And so that's why I think a couple years ago, right, you saw a renewal or an early renewal of the deal. I think that's accurate. And, so my gut is that everyone, the thing about this that's so unique is it literally impacts all of us. And, you know, certainly NBA owners and NBA players have the resources to maybe withstand a lot of this. But, you know, a lot of the younger players are taking care of, you know, a lot of people in their families. And even though their salary may sound large at $1 million, $1.5 million, you know, that can go quick. And you can be, you know, maybe not paycheck to paycheck, but, you know, it's not quite as much money as people think when you start taking care of multiple generations of a family or trying to do that for young players. And so, you know, that's why it's really, this impacts all of us differently, and it impacts all players differently too. Certainly the higher end players and, you know, the owners have the wherewithal to withstand something like this, but it's impacting all of their businesses too, in a way that is, you know, that can be hugely significant. So my gut is something gets done because everyone's impacted by this and we all want to see basketball come back. And they understand that the NBA is a great business. And once the economy gets going again, you know, the NBA will continue to be a great business.
You know, and one thing I didn't know, and I just kind of learned about with player contracts recently when a couple of players were talking to me about it, was I had assumed maybe foolishly for a while that, you know, player contracts ran through the end of the season and they didn't get paid until the next season started up. But for the most part, and correct me if I'm wrong here, players are getting paid all throughout the year. Like the financial calendar year, I believe, ends like it's October 15th to November 1st or something like that. And so if the players wind up missing out on paychecks, if this force majeure clause is eventually enforced, that could affect like 6 months of paychecks if this season doesn't get started again, right?
Yeah, it can. And you know, this is one of those things that is hard for, you know, players. Like they're probably 60% through their current salary, right? Year. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a real, especially for, you know, younger players or players that maybe have, you know, signed non-drafted player, right, who signed a minimum contract or a two-way player. You know, there's the trickle down, the G League players, you know, who are playing, you know, for, you know, not very much money at all to just you know, show that they have an opportunity, or, you know, that they're worthy of an NBA contract or an NBA call up. And so, I mean, there's a huge trickle down impact across the league. And certainly this paycheck element, if players end up not getting paid because of the lost revenue to the league, I mean, it'll hurt a lot of people and a lot of players in the NBA.
Yeah, no question about that. So there's a financial cost, Wes, and then there's a basketball cost to all this. And when people ask me, like, which player would be most disappointed or most impacted by a lost season, the answer is the same every time to me, and it's LeBron James, who at 35 years old is just having an amazing season, MVP caliber year, and he's on a team that was playing its best basketball by the time the season was suspended. So let me ask you this. Will a lost season cost LeBron maybe his best chance of winning a championship when you look at, you know, basically the field this year and what the field and the Lakers could look like next year?
I hope not. I hope we have a chance to see LeBron, you know, play for another opportunity to championship. And you're right, the Lakers were playing, you know, great basketball, having won 11 of 13 before the stoppage, with their best week with wins against Philly, Milwaukee, you know, the Clippers. And their two losses in those 13 games was one at Memphis and then Brooklyn against the shorthanded Brooklyn team. So this Laker team, man, was rolling. LeBron's having a great year. I certainly hope we get to see LeBron play, because you're right. It would be a basketball loss if we wouldn't get to see him. I'm just optimistic and hopeful we can come back. And I hate to consider the idea of, you know, losing, you know, the opportunity to see LeBron try to compete for another championship, and all the other players too. I mean, the Milwaukee Bucks are off to an incredible, you know, season. And I would hate to not be able to see Giannis could potentially compete in the finals to maybe win a championship, or the Clippers were just getting healthy and that team coming together with all the moves that they've made. So I hope we get to see the basketball component of this. And, you know, I don't know if you're going to get into this or not, Chris, but there's also like an impact on the financials for teams, like, you know, positively probably for Detroit and Miami and what they did at the trade deadline to create great flexibility for their teams going forward. And if the cap comes down, that means the tax going to come down, and teams like, you know, Golden State, Philly, Brooklyn, and Boston, who are projected to be a tax team next year, could be even more negatively impacted if that tax number, you know, goes down, which ultimately sends their tax bill up because we're modeling salaries that are largely on their books.
Yeah, it could change a lot of things if that year is lost. I look at the Lakers too, and again, I'm with you. You know, goes without saying, I want to see the league come back. But, you know, the Lakers, they do have a little bit of flexibility next year from what I'm able to kind of understand. And they've got that exception that's going to be worth about, what, $9.5-$10 million next year. And then they have the smaller exception, I believe, that's like $3-$3.5 million in that range. So they'll be able to go out, I think, and attract guys. The question is like, has LeBron and Anthony Davis and Los Angeles established LA as that go-to market or go-to place to go and sign with? And if they have, I mean, they were competing with the Clippers for a couple of guys during the buyout period. And look, they didn't get Reggie Jackson. They couldn't make a deal for Marcus Morris, which is less about them than it is about the Clippers' willingness to deal certain things. But I wonder if it comes down to, I guess I'll phrase the question this way. If it comes down to like Lakers versus Clippers in hunting for those kind of free agents that will take a little bit less, does one team have the edge there in your mind? Have Wes, what you've seen happen during the buyout period, does that tell you anything about maybe the appeal of the Clippers versus the Lakers?
No, it doesn't. And you know, those exceptions that you mentioned are likely to come down with the cap if the cap comes down.
Right.
And you know, the Clippers are also going to be a team functioning above the cap, you know, for the foreseeable future. And so I think you're going to get really good, you know, these teams, the Lakers and the Clippers are going to end up getting players in free agency that are going to be champion, you know, that are going to be hunting championships, or wanting to play with the best players in the NBA and wanting to play in a great market and wanting to play for organizations that are incredibly well run, that are willing to spend whatever it takes to win. And so ultimately we're still going to be players, you know, the Clippers and Lakers are going to be fighting over players for a long time, for many, many years to come.
Yeah, it was kind of the game within the game at the buyout deadline, where you knew the Clippers and Lakers wanted similar players, and it was just a battle between those two teams. Let me finish with this, Wes. It was just a few weeks ago that Steve Koonin, the CEO of the Hawks, someone you work with in Atlanta, was at the Sloan Analytics Conference, and he was advocating for a permanent change in the NBA schedule. Koonin's plan is to basically start the NBA season in mid-December, thereby avoiding competing with the NFL, and stretching the season into July and August, where the only competition is regular season baseball. So let me ask you, as a person invested in the NBA, what do you think of that plan?
You know, I'm more of a traditionalist. I like having our summer as is. But I'm also like understanding that, you know, it's always good to have these ideas come up and be creative. Steve Koonin, the CEO of Atlanta, you know, CEO of the Hawks, he presented this idea to us multiple times. Adam Silver was asked about this by Rachel Nichols on ESPN. Under his leadership, the NBA continues to be creative, continues to be flexible, continues to look at, you know, different ways, you know, to work through a season. And maybe there's an opportunity now to potentially try some of this stuff. Ultimately, though, Chris, like the league is led by smart people. They're smart people at ESPN and Warner Media and the regional sports networks who ultimately drive programming. And so that's, I just have great confidence that we're going to end up in a good place and those people are going to make the best decisions for programming. And if that means, you know, the schedule changes, then it would be, you know, interesting to see how it plays out.
When this was brought up during your time in Atlanta, what was the argument? Is the argument against as simple as TV networks don't want games, like consequential games in the summertime, because the ratings might go down? Does it boil down to that, or is there more to it?
I think the traditional concern is that, or thought is, and I'm not a media guy, but I have had a bunch of conversations with media people about this, is, you know, the summer is when people are out of the house. The summer is when people are on vacation. And that's why, you know, fall is when you see all the, new shows start on the major networks. But we're consuming media differently than ever before. You know, we're now all on our phones. So maybe on vacation, we can download games and watch and stream stuff in a way that, you know, wasn't something we could do regularly. An interesting thing. So on Deals and Dunks with Joel Myers on SiriusXM Radio, we kind of had a conversation and we had a bunch of people calling in about this. And I was surprised. And it actually moved my opinion a little bit. Every caller that called in, and I bet you we had 7 callers, and every one of them thought that it was a great idea to potentially move into the summer for the schedule. Everyone had like a slightly different reason. So maybe there's an opportunity with all that's going on now. But again, I'm just so confident in, you know, the leadership at ESPN, Warner Media, and the league office that, you know, they're going to do what's best to try to navigate this current unusual landscape, as well as try to figure out the best way to, you know, like schedule the NBA season.
First, that's the second SiriusXM show you've mentioned. How many shows do you do over there at this point? What are we?
Well, Deals and Dunks is every Saturday. We do that one regularly. they kind of move me around on the other shows, but most recently I've been on the starting lineup with Frank Isola, and he's a lot of fun.
Yes.
He's like you, Chris. He does a great job, and I just try not to screw things up.
Well, look, listen, I could have been one of those callers that was an advocate for this change, because I'm a big believer in this, and it's for a couple of reasons. One, I think we can both kind of agree that the first 2 months of the season are just kind of like empty calories in a way. Like they just don't move the needle all that much. You ask most average fans and they feel like the NBA season, you know, begins at Christmas, and they really start paying attention in January, February. So you get away from the competition of college football, of the NFL, of even the first month or so of the NHL, for whatever that's worth, maybe even the World Series if you're playing in November, and you kind of liberate yourself from that by starting in December. And look, I agree as well with what you're saying. Like, we consume media significantly differently than we did 4 or 5 years ago, or even 2 or 3 years ago. I remember having this conversation with people in boxing, which is another sport that I'm pretty invested in. And there was a time, Wes, when putting on fights on HBO or Showtime in the summertime, you only did that if you absolutely had to. You never wanted to do that. Then a couple of years ago, you had networks and streaming services start to have success with summer shows. And now that real estate is prime real estate for boxing promoters. They want to do fights in the summertime because, again, people will take it on their phone. They'll watch a pay-per-view here. They'll watch it on the beach. They'll go out as much. So, and I've done some reporting on this in the last couple of days, and you know, talking to Mark Cuban, he is an advocate for this. He believes that there's some real merit to this argument, and he bases some of it on his Shark Tank ratings in the summertime. Not exactly sure if there's a correlation there, but I also talked to John Skipper about this, who ran ESPN for decades, and you know, John said to me, in all the times that all the conversations he had with the NBA about different adjustments, they never really had a conversation about playing basketball and changing the schedule so it's summer basketball. And he says, at least he believes now, that it could work. He thinks that viewing habits have changed and that it could be successful. I think that if the league comes back in the summertime, you could get some really valuable data that could inform you about your opinion, or what your opinion should be about this moving forward. If these ratings are really high, I think that might be just the nudge to have the league really start to work towards changing that schedule. Now, it won't happen automatically, or won't happen the next season because of myriad issues, not the least of which is the collective bargaining agreement. You've got to deal with networks and television deals. But the next time TV deals come up, Wes, if it's a successful summer, I think you're going to see teams, or I think you're going to see the league gravitate towards that. I don't want to lose my summer either, but I think that there's a lot of merit to competing with virtually nobody in the summertime.
Yeah, I mean, and this is why I think it's going to be vetted deeply. All the points you raise, there will be a lot studied out of this summer. We have to, I probably recognize that the numbers we see are going to be artificially inflated this summer, just because we haven't had basketball for so long. And if this is some sort of new, unique finish to the year, if it's not traditional, that probably will drive interest as well. But all of this is, again, like, all of this will be considered. You just have to love the creativity, the open-mindedness of the NBA, all the talk. And we talked so much, we might have even talked to Chris about, the different options for the schedule, compressing the schedule, the play-in tournament, the in-season tournament. And there was a lot of differing opinions to that stuff. And now maybe like, we're going to have a chance to test all of that and test it in the summer, to your point, to see, if there might be a time that, because we all consume media differently, there might be an opportunity to actually make a shift in the schedule where there is less competition of the other major sports.
Look, as someone that doesn't tan particularly well, I'm cool with having like September and October off. Like, I'm good. I'll go to Boston College football games and I'll enjoy the fall drinking season. I'm good with that. Like, that,
we all personalize it though, right? Like, yes. All of us personalize it in some way or another.
I'd tell you this much though. Like, when I was tweeting about this a little bit, I think Bobby Marks was like, kind of listed out what a potential schedule would look like. And I sort of subtweeted him and said, like, I'm all for this. Like, I had half a dozen other reporters and a couple of NBA types text me like, no way, don't want to get my summertime. I need that summertime. Like, all right, man, well, adapt or die, baby. Like, let's let's go.
There's no doubt, though. Like, we like that time, But let's keep it real. The off-season is a myth in the NBA.
Exactly.
Right. There's a downtime where we're not quite as on. But the NBA now dominates July as it is because of NBA Summer League. What the league office, in conjunction with Warren Legarry and Albert Hall, what they have done with Summer League, it has, and then layer on top of that, all the intrigue with player movement and free agency and the player empowerment era. We dominate July. Like, even 5 years ago, like, we didn't dominate July the way we do now. And now we dominate July. It's an incredible thing. And so maybe we can do the same and just, expand that to take over August and September as well. And, we all work the majority of the time anyways throughout the year. And It would just be a little bit different cycle, you know, and where you have your peak times and where you have a little bit of time where you can decompress.
It's, to your point, it's very, very limited. I mean, God, I remember, and I try to, like, as a personal example, I try to go away and unplug for like the last week in August every year, which is a decent time to potentially do it. And I remember, was it a couple of years ago, I'm sitting on a beach and all of a sudden my phone's blowing up because Kyrie Irving's getting traded to Boston. Like, that every August, there's always a deal. Like, there's always some big deal in August that consumes like 3 or 4 days of the news cycle. And it just never stops, man.
Chris, but to your point, I don't know the percentage, but the vast majority of the NBA who has been in the NBA while they were married, or, you know, are August anniversaries. So we would displace all of those, you know, anniversary trips if we moved the NBA schedule, and we would now end up with something around the lines of, you know, all those future people in the NBA are going to have September and or October maybe wedding anniversaries. to your point, like, because, you know, we try to find those windows of time to where we can take a breath, but the NBA keeps moving and deals keep getting done.
Yeah, no question. Wes, appreciate your time, man. Good luck with the geometry homework. If I can be of any use, I feel free to reach out, but there's no chance I could be of any use. There's just zero chance of that.
Thanks so much, Chris.